Hello, Mr. Raphael. How are you, my man?
Hello, Enrique. Nice to be here with you. I'm good, thank you.
How about
yourself?
Great to be here. Great. I'm fine. I'm really fine. Great that you are here. And thank you again for accepting the invitation. It's literally an honor to talk with you. Your human trophic level was a game changer in my practice and in my teaching too.
I'm glad to hear it. I'm glad I had a positive impact.
Yeah, yeah. So let me see. Let's start with your presentation. Tell a little bit about yourself. How did you begin this interest in anthropology? Tell a little bit.
So my interest in anthropology, paleoanthropology, so the study of human diets and what we evolved to eat. I think my father really loved this topic when I was young. I remember him talking to me about it. And I think I forgot about it for many years through adolescence. And then it reemerged later on when I got interested in evolutionary theory, evolution by natural selection, you know, Darwin's theory. And this really fascinated me, and I learned that it was the most powerful idea in biology. And so years later, when I read Gary Taubes' book, Good Calories, Bad Calories, I became very interested in nutrition. And then so I had these two new interests, evolutionary biology and nutrition. And so I decided that the framework for nutrition should be evolutionary biology. And that's how I'm here today, you know, asking people to consider ancestral diets to fix their health issues. So that's how I came about it. And I think it's something that's sorely lacking in mainstream medicine.
Yeah, yeah. And your original graduation is in what area?
So I have a master's in molecular biology. I also have a management studies degree that's totally unrelated. But my master's in molecular biology, and I did 4 years of a PhD, which I didn't complete during the time of COVID. But during those 4 years, I did a lot of neuroscience experiments, working with rodents on a rodent model of schizophrenia. So I was using rats to look at the metabolic side effects of antipsychotics that we, you know, typically give to patients because they generate a lot of insulin resistance, weight gain, other issues, and I wanted to study that, and I managed to have an arm of the diet trial actually on a ketogenic diet.
So I
got to do some work in that area, but unfortunately the results were never published because at the time they didn't like publishing negative results, null results. So unfortunately what we get in the literature is a very biased picture.
Yeah, yeah. And how was the contact with Mickey Bendor and the writing of that the article?
Yeah, like most of the good scientific things in my life, they tend to start on Twitter. So I've been exchanging with Mickey for years and years. I think the first time we met may have been in low carb Denver. Before that, actually, probably in Tel Aviv. In Israel when I went for a conference there for my PhD, and then in Tel Aviv where he lives. And then at Low Carb Denver in 2020 and also at the Metabolics Conference in Tel Aviv a few years later. So met him a few times and mainly through Twitter, but we decided to collaborate on this question that wasn't really addressed in the literature satisfactorily.
Yeah, that's very interesting, and I'm a fan of your work. I'm a fan of the Mickey Bendor's work, and if you can tell a little bit to us, how was the evolution of our food? How was we were not always omnivores or carnivores. We begin as vegetarians, like let's say the herbivores. How was the pressure, the natural selection that made us switch from vegetables, from plants to meat, and then became the ones that we are today?
Yeah, so we can think of it in by looking at two species in two different times. So during a time frame called the Pliocene, that's about 5.3 million years ago to 2.58 million years ago. In that time, there was a species called Australopithecus, and he wouldn't really look human to us. They were, standing upright, but they would look more like a chimp maybe than a human. And they would eat fruit, vegetables, small insects, lizards, tubers, that sort of diet. So it was really sort of, very high in fiber, not very energy dense, scavenging, and also, gathering and, small, very small prey. So this would, in one way of calling that would be a low quality diet. Not because it's bad for the species, just because it's not very dense, it's not very caloric, it takes a lot of time, you have to spend a lot of time chewing, eating, you don't have a lot of time for other things.
They
Then in
were
the Pleistocene, yes, please.
they were already in the ground, or they were still in the trees,
They
Australopithecus.
were already on the ground at this point. So because there's a lot of tubers which are underground and, to cover distances, to increase the diets, there were already some, bipedal, basically. So
Yeah, thanks.
when the Pleistocene time came, so that's between 2.5 million years to about 11,200 years ago. So now we're getting much closer to nowadays by about 12,000 years. And during that time, there was Homo sapiens, which is our, what we are basically. We're Homo sapiens sapiens, and that we are different from Australopithecus because our diet became very high quality. So most of our diets, I would say about 70% or more of the calories came from animals, and not small animals like insects and lizards, but really big animals like mammoths or, hippos or rhinos, elephants. The sort of animals that have a lot of fat, and when you successfully hunt them, there's a huge energetic return compared to eating vegetables, fruits, small insects. So of course it's very hard to kill a big animal, but it's very good if you can because you get a huge reward. So it's like a big gamble. And humans became apex predators, which means they were at the top of the food chain. And this was largely because of technology, our very intelligent brains that allowed us to develop this technology and figure out how to coordinate and generate hunting tools and techniques so that we can take down huge prey, which have a lot of fat and a lot of nutrients, and forced us to cook it because not only did we hunt, but then we further concentrated the food and made it further easy to digest and more bioavailable. So we really had this incredible ability to get nutrients and calories unlike many other species. And this is potentially why our brain and intelligence is so unique amongst animals on Earth. Food probably has a big role to do with this. There are other reasons than food, but food and fat and calories and animal foods are a big part of it.
In this transition from plants to meat to animals, we have the some adaptations, some changes in our physiology and in our morphology. One thing that comes to mind is the expensive tissue hypothesis. that says that our brain developed and our intestines shrink. So can you tell a little bit about these adaptations?
Yeah, so looking at the brain and the gut anatomy is a very good thing to look at, because it really helps you understand what foods likely came through our guts and our mouths. Because unlike hind gut fermenting animals or herbivores, who basically have to spend many hours a day eating low quality, meaning high fiber, low calorie foods, they use these foods to ferment in their various rumen, for example, and the bacteria basically turn the indigestible cellulose into fat. And this allows them to extract, a lot of energy, but it takes a lot of work, a lot of time, a lot of fermentation. It's not a very great return on investment, in a sense. It's a different strategy. For humans, we went a totally different way. Our guts shrank because we cooked foods and because the foods were very calorie and very nutrient dense. So we didn't need all this added surface area and fermentation chambers to extract energy from low quality foods. And this high calorie, high nutrient density diet really is what you need if you're going to grow a big brain, because the brain, a lot of energy that we expend is just our brain running in the background, doing its day-to-day operations. It requires a lot of cholesterol, a lot of fatty acids. It's very expensive tissue to build, and you can see it in children. I mean, they take so many years to develop to full size and to mature and to become intelligent, because the brain requires so much energy and developmental time. And you need a certain gut to do this. And that's why our gut adapted to eat the foods that were going to allow us to achieve this brain building project that we achieved.
Yeah. And there are another adaptations, like because when you talk nowadays, there is a great media saying that we should eat only plants. And the people that say that usually do say that our teeth are not able to cut meat. There's no fangs, and we have no claws, and we have no strength, and all the things that we see, of course, in carnivores, in tigers and lions. But at the same time, we know that that our ancestors were eating animals. So what's the difference between a human carnivore and a natural, let's say, lion, tiger, carnivore? Why should we eat meat?
Yeah, so that's a really important question. And whether how we classify ourselves really tells us what we think about the diet we should be eating. So typically, the mainstream, I would say, consensus view is that humans are omnivores. And there's some truth to that. It's true in the extent that we can be healthy on an omnivorous eating pattern with plants and animals. That's correct. However, in terms of formal classification of our species, I would argue that we're hypercarnivores. And I think it's a very good argument for that. The reason the term hypercarnivore sounds extreme in the mind of people, but there's a technical meaning. The technical meaning is 70% or more calories from animals. So you can be a hypercarnivore and still have 30% of calories coming from plants, which for many people is not too different from how they eat, if you actually look at the calorie distribution. At least for many people in the low carb community, even who aren't carnivore, 20, 30% calories from animals, that's a low carb paleo diet, basically. So yeah. Hypercarnivore is compatible with an omnivorous eating pattern. And this is, scientists are not very clear in how they make definitions, but I think hopefully this helps clear up confusion. Now, the reason we're hypercarnivores is because meat is essential for us in the technical sense, meaning if we don't eat meat, we will have deficiencies, we will be sick. If infants aren't fed, for example, infants actually are fed 100% carnivore diet when they're breastfeeding. It is animals, calories coming from animals, right? At the very basic level. So this is the natural way that humans develop brains, they develop it on a carnivore diet from their mother. And then when they grow older, you know, they can vary their diet more, they can include more plants, they're more adaptable. But the carnivore diet is key to our species, and we have many pieces of evidence for this. So if you want, I can go through, you know, a short list, and you can stop me at
any moment
if you have a question.
Yeah, please.
So we already talked about the energetic returns that you get from hunting animals versus gathering plants. And that's about 10 times more with animals than plants. So from the advantage perspective of our species, it's very clear. If you can hunt animals, you should hunt them, basically.
Yeah. So this and that's why herbivores keep chewing all day long, just because they don't have enough energy to extract from that.
Right. We can even see the difference between a wolf and a cow. The wolf hunts and rests most of the time and plays, and then goes hunting. A cow has a different strategy, and you know, one is a carnivore and the other is a herbivore. So we fit more. We're actually more carnivorous than wolves, if you look at the stable isotope data. So this is one very important line of evidence. There's something called a nitrogen-15 stable isotope, and this is a form of nitrogen that we can look at in human fossil collagen. So fossils from humans that still have collagen in it, collagen residues, if they're, you know, around 50,000 years old. We can use this technique to look at where the nitrogen comes from. Does it come more from plants or more from animals? And when we look at the ratios of certain of these isotopes, which are forms of nitrogen, we can put you, you know, more or less close to carnivore or herbivore or that sort of thing, or even protein coming from the sea versus protein coming from the land. You can do it with carbon, you can do it with different atoms. When you look at this whole area of study, it's very clear. Humans are as carnivorous of wolves, if not even more. And I think even vegetarians would admit that wolves are carnivores. So if we are, you know, at least as carnivorous as them, clearly we're made to eat a lot of animals. So I think that's a really important piece. Then we have also the very high percentage of body fats. If you look at a human versus a chimpanzee or other primates, they're extremely lean, you know, 2% fat or something. A very lean human who looks, you know, very good at the gym, a man, is going to have maybe 9%, 10% fats. So like way more than the normal chimp. So humans have very high amount of fat because our metabolism really relies on fat. Fundamentally, it's a fat-burning metabolism. Yes, we can use glucose, but even if you're a glucose eater, you're still burning a lot of fat, right?
Yeah.
So that's one thing. Then we also have a genetic evidence. For example, when we look at the genome, there are areas which are shut down, meaning they're like chromatin clamps, right? They shut the genome down so that it can't be read and expressed. And the regions that are shut down show that this is because we want to increase sort of the fat metabolism genes. And in chimpanzees who are more reliant on fruit, we see that they want to open the genes for, you know, sugar metabolism, which is makes total sense for their diets. So we have a genetic level of evidence there. Then we have another really important part back to your point about anatomy, stomach pH. So the pH of the stomach, how acidic the stomach is. I mean, humans are incredibly acidic. Their stomachs are around 1.5 to 1.7 median pH, which is as acidic as a vulture. So really, really acidic. Like scavengers, we can eat fermented foods with a lot of bacteria. We have you know, many traditions, right, to eat fermented food. Yeah. This is because the pH protects our stomach from the bacteria. So this is what you need if you're a carnivore, because you will be eating animals, they will have bacteria. It's not like just eating fruits in a tree. So there's a different need for stomach pH. So we're on the same level as scavengers.
This pH, Rafael, it's very hard to keep a low pH like that. So it's energetically demanding. And I think that we won't be able to digest protein, animal protein, if we have a pH much higher than that. That we can see in cows and horses that are pH about 6-7. And this low pH, it means that begin to eat animals in a rotten way or in the leftovers of another carnivores when we were, let's say, less evolved?
Right. Yeah, we could scavenge. Before we were good at hunting, we would scavenge what the lion had killed, and he had left some pieces. They had started to rot. There were some flies, but we were hungry. We needed to go. We went, we ate it, and we could survive because we had acid in our stomach. And as you said, it's a very expensive production. It takes a lot of energy, and you're only going to do this if you're going to have a return on your investment. And that's what hunting, scavenging. We would break open the bone marrow, a lot of fat. We would break open the skull with a rock. We would break it. We would get access to the brains. And we could do this because the animals, like the lions, weren't smart enough. So for us, it was a good investment to have, a high pH. But for the baboon, it maybe doesn't make as much sense because why would they need to invest there?
Yeah,
Yeah,
great.
absolutely. Should I continue or do you want to
Yeah,
go on another
please.
question? There's also the low physiological insulin sensitivity. So I'm going to explain what this means. We talk a lot about metabolic syndrome and all of these things. And one of the key aspects of a lot of modern diseases nowadays, the diseases of civilization, is that people are insulin resistant, the bad type of insulin resistance, the pathological one. This is when your muscles, your brain, or whatever tissue wants to have access to glucose and fatty acids and fails to gain access to it because insulin is supposed to bring energy into cells. And when the cell resists this, the cell can't get the energy. So you are what we call insulin resistant. This means you're diabetic in a very simplified way. So humans, there's also the normal insulin resistance, which is what you get when you're pregnant. So women often develop insulin resistance during pregnancy, and we call this gestational diabetes. We call it a disease, but it's not really a disease. It's just their body resisting insulin at the muscles so that the glucose they produce can go to the baby and to the mother's brains. So there's a pathological kind, which is diabetes, and then there is the physiological kind, which is just a mechanism how humans evolve. And carnivores tend to be physiologically insulin resistant. So this is another aspect where we are similar to, other carnivores like lions and things like that. So that's one aspect. We also, like we mentioned before, very overall smaller gut anatomy. So we have very long, small intestines. And very short, large intestines, because the small intestine is where you absorb like the meat, the protein, the sugar, and the large intestines is where you would ferment more, let's say, in a sense. So we have shortened the part we don't use as much. Our colon also is quite short, small fermentative capacity, but a longer small intestines. You also mentioned our teeth, our jaw. Actually, our jaw is much smaller than most other animals. It reduced. When we were, more like Australopithecus that we were talking about, many millions of years ago, we had a much bigger jaw, much wider teeth that could really grind a lot of hard, nuts, plants, tubers, that sort of thing. Now we have a much smaller jaw. It's not as powerful because we have the technology to cook our animals and our plants, and so our jaw and teeth have adapted to that. So that's, one other example. There's a really cool one. We have a shoulder that's actually made for throwing. If you look at other animals, other apes, they don't really have this anatomy to throw well. Humans can throw extremely well, precisely from far. And you're doing this if you hunt. You're not throwing like this to catch a fruit in the tree, right? You're doing this to take down an elephant. And that's a huge, huge anatomical change for hunting. Our fat cells, if you look at our number of fat cells, we have many small insulin sensitive fat cells. So we have four times more fat cells per unit weight than other primates. So the primates, they don't need fat tissue, to fast, for example. They don't need it because they're eating all the time. They're eating the trees, the fruits, the tubers. We have fat cells that really say, yes, these species need to fast and they need to, be able to absorb the fats and be insulin sensitive to it. We live long. Right? Much longer than many other chimps. species. And one reason, one speculated reason, it's because it takes time to become a good hunter. You know, in tribes, the experience peaks around age 40. 40 years old is probably when they're very strong physically and have a lot of experience. And you're not going to, you know, get there if you're only very like a dog where you live 15, 20 years. You're not going to have the hunting experience necessary. So that's one other aspect. Let's see, dental caries. When you go to the dentist because you have a carie, that didn't exist more than 15,000 years ago. Those appeared in the human remains record about 15,000 years ago. So again, we know why people get caries. I think this is probably one of the most accepted facts in medicine. Sugar gives you caries. So yeah. This is not something, you know, we have been consuming in large amounts continuously throughout the year, like that. So the teeth tell us a lot. And lastly, it's not anatomy, but it's actually a behavioral aspect. And carnivores have a lot of social flexibility. They divide labor, they share food, and they alloparent, meaning that they don't just take care of their children. They tend to take care of the children of their cousin or aunt, or they take care of other children. So these are all overlaps behaviorally that also suggest we're a carnivore. So it's not just the anatomy; it's also the hunting and the behavior. So there are many, many, many reasons why we're carnivores. This is why I think it's, I like to tell this, and I'm glad you're asking me the questions, because this is not usually discussed in nutrition conversations, but I think it's the real science about how you decide,
Yeah. And the things you said about fasting, I think this is one of the main reasons that we have the health crisis that we are in today, because we are made to fast. We have the small cells, many small cells, adipose cells, and at this time of the our evolution, we are not fasting at all. I think the average human are eating about 12 to 16 hours a day. It only stop eating when we are asleep, and even there's some people that wake up in the midnight to make a snack. Then it's very interesting that you say that, because recently, we have an article in the American Heart Association blog. I think you have read it, that says that fasting increased 91% the chance of cardiac death and CVD, cardiac disease. Yeah. And it's interesting that the medical profession and the nutrition profession don't even knows about that you are saying.
It's really like waking up from a bad dream, but you're still in the bad dream, you're still in the nightmare, because it's like having physicists who don't really understand that the earth is going around the sun. In medicine, nutrition, people don't understand that what we ate in the past strongly informs how we should be eating today. And as long as this fact isn't appreciated, taught in medical school, taught to nutritionists, we're going to be stuck doing the same mistakes again and again and again. And this is why it's not a sexy idea to talk about evolution, but it's also what's needed to get a meaningful conversation. So saying that you're going to increase your risk of death because you fast in a species who's exquisitely adapted to fasting, because we can produce ketones amazingly easily. Infants, when they're born and breastfeeding, they produce ketones. And they produce ketones on a diet that's 40% lactose, so 40% carbs. They're still producing ketones. You can measure this in a baby who's, don't believe me, you can measure it in a baby. It's very easy to check.
I'll be doing I'll be doing this if my wife let me, because she's pregnant right now.
Fantastic.
I don't think she's gonna let me do this.
Yeah, my wife didn't, so I'll let some other father confirm.
Yeah.
But Yeah, like even compared to dogs, you know, they can a dog can doesn't have to eat every day. He can skip a day, but he's not going to go into ketosis. Humans, we skip, you know, one day, half a day, we go into ketosis so easily. We're really, really strong fat burners, and we're also endurance animals. We probably persistence hunted, meaning we're not fast, but if we keep running behind the prey for hours, we can exhaust them and they will fall because they cannot sweat and cool their body temperature, and we can sweat and we can run and we can do this all day. I mean, marathoners show this, trail runners show this, tribes show this, even a horse. Humans can outrun a horse long distance, which is, you know, incredible. So clearly, you need a fat-based metabolism to do that. You cannot be reliant on a portable source of glucose with you. So there are so many lines of evidence for this.
And that's interesting because today we have this I call vegan agenda. I think I can call that. And it's like going backwards from what we should eating, and it's like an ideology because it doesn't have a solid science to back them. But we see they are advancing, and the people are saying that. And you have this in nutrition that a vegan diet is more healthy than a diet that includes meat. But what's your opinion about this? What's your opinion about veganism? Is it sustainable? Is it possible to be a vegan without some supplements? Because some people say to me, but can't and that shows that the evolution knowledge is a little bit complex and mistaken the people of the lay people but can't we adapt to be vegan? So what can you tell about this?
So this is actually a really important point because oftentimes people say, look, humans adapt, you know, over a couple thousands of years. And they always give the same example. They say, look, we can digest lactose, right? They say the lactase persistence. So this is where you need to understand a little bit of molecular biology to understand why it's not a good example. So lactase persistence evolved over, you know, about what was it in the last 5-10,000 years around there. So a relatively short amount of time from the point of view of a species. Now, the adaptation is what we call a simple genetic adaptation or mutation. So we have the mechanism to digest milk, right? All babies digest the mother's milk. So we know, we all agree, we have this mechanism. The ability to keep digesting it during adulthood is simply not letting it turn off. So the genes that are working to give you the lactase enzyme to digest milk, rather than shut off, we adapt it to keep it on. That's all it is. Extremely simple. It can happen over a short period of time. Now, adapting to a vegan diet, meaning to a high fiber, low calorie density, low nutrient density, low quality diet, that requires a huge amount of adaptation. That requires changing the gut anatomy, changing the teeth, changing the behavior, this time you spend, you know, it's like everything changes. You're a completely different species. So vegan diet, adapting to a vegan diet is totally different than adapting to keep an adaptation that already exists. You know, it's not even comparable. So the vegan diet, we cannot adapt to it over a short amount of time. It would take hundreds of thousands of years to adapt to it. By the normal process of evolution. And really, veganism, I think, is a unhealthy diet at any age, but it's specifically for infants. So when we talk about healthy diets, people tend to assume we're talking about adults because adults are the people who choose how they eat, right? But of course, they have to choose for their children. So it's also important to judge a diet along the whole spectrum of life, not just on one moment in life. So when we judge by the whole spectrum in life, no infant can survive a pure vegan diet. Infants have died on vegan diets, and there is a law in Italy, in Belgium, I think also in another European country, that if parents put infants on vegan diets, they can go to jail because it's considered human abuse to not properly nourish an infant. And I think that's very reasonable and very strong scientific basis for saying it should be illegal for infants. Now, once you are an adult and you can make your own decisions, I would not recommend you go on a vegan diet for many, many reasons, but of course you're free to do it. And the problem is this, you won't have enough B12, you won't have a good amino acid profile, you won't have omega-3 DHA, you won't have ketones present because your diet is 99% likely to be high carb, although it is technically possible to be keto on vegan, but extremely rare, extremely complicated.
Yes. And very hard to do it.
Very, very hard. So it's really the exception that proves the rule. Of course, you will suffer gastric issues, probably other allergy, inflammation, autoimmune issues. But it's possible that coming off a terrible junk food industrial diet, for a while, you may feel better. That's true. That's possible. It happens. So generally, so if you come to our medical clinic, we will work with vegans and vegetarians, but we will never give you the impression that it's healthy. We will tell you the truth, and then we will help you make it, you know, less bad as possible. But we will encourage you to consider a higher quality diet for your health and for your mental health. So if you're a vegan vegetarian, you want to come work with us, please do. And if you want to challenge us, please do. We encourage all our patients to challenge us, send us papers, share videos. We're very open to discussing because these are hard, complex issues. And we all came from a place of ignorance at some point. So it's totally fine. So yeah, I don't think it's a good diet to have really at any age.
Yeah. And we have here in Brazil a nutritionist that is vegan, and he is very it's a very influencing person. Mm-hmm. And he's keeping going on podcasts and things like that. And recently I saw a video that he says that humans are not meant to eat too much proteins. And he says that the human breast milk only have 6% protein. And that's a reason that human, if babies that are growing don't need protein, adults don't need protein too. That's his argument. What do you think about that?
It's a very clever argument. I have to give him credit because I can see why this is very convincing to people. Mm-hmm. And a lot of vegan influencers, they may be wrong, but they're not necessarily stupid. So we have to give him credit for that. So in this case, it is true. Breast milk has about 6 to 8% protein, depending on the stage, because the amount of protein changes throughout the first month. So first you have colostrum in the first days when the baby is born. Then you have called the first milk. And then you have the mature milk. And even the milk when the baby is feeding at the beginning and 20 minutes later is different. The first milk is actually lower in fat and higher in other nutrients. And then after 20 minutes or something of breastfeeding, it's higher fat. So depending when you measure the time of life, it's very different. So it's not so easy to generalize. But in general, yes, it's relatively low protein compared to the amount that we need as adults. And I think there are probably multiple reasons for this. But the first one is that it's not that protein is bad, it's that fat is really important. And so you want the diet to be high in energy. You want it in lactose, in carbs, and you want it high in fat. And you keep protein to whatever the body needs at minimum, but it's not beneficial to go higher protein. So that's the first thing. Second of all, a baby is what? It's very fat and it has a big head, right? So it's a high body fat, high percentage of cholesterol in the brain, all of this. So you don't really need protein for this at that stage. That's not what you're sustaining. Once you're an adult, right, your head is smaller compared to your body, and now your body has much more muscle mass. So your needs for protein are going to adapt now that you're an adult. So this is very easily explained by looking at the developmental phases in life. And I
Yeah.
think it's a very intuitive concept that these things change depending on your phase, right? So everyone understands that you cannot feed a baby a salad when they are 3 months old because we know their digestive system is not adapted. And so it's the same things for these other aspects of micronutrients. Once the baby is, away from the mother, the immune system has been formed by all the immune factors the mother has given them. So they're more able to interact with the outside world, with different foods, with different bacteria. So this is always changing and adapting. And I think this vegan argument is trying to tell us to forget these complexities to give us a simple argument. And this is rarely, rarely correct, of course.
Yeah, and we can see that we see older men, elderly, that we have sarcopenia. That is a loss of muscle, and we see the sarcopenia going forward in a very in a very rapid way if you don't have the if you don't have the adequate diet. And especially if you don't have the adequate diet and the physical activity. So, but some people that have dysphagia, that it's the problem to eat, to chew, né? Some elderly that have smaller teeth, so don't have all the teeth. And we have to put them in protein supplements so they cannot lose muscle mass. So compare a baby to a grown man. It's a clever argument because everyone says that the breast milk, the mother milk is the best food for our species. Everybody says that, but it's the best food for us, but in a certain period of life, not in every. No, there's no way we can sustain an adult with breast milk.
Yeah, and also you should ask the influencer if the diet generates ketones, shouldn't your vegan diet be ketogenic then? By the same standard, right? If
Yeah,
low
that's
protein
a
is
great
good, then
question.
high fat, high protein, high ketones is going to be good as well, right? So,
Yeah, that's a great. I
yeah.
think he'll eat avocados for the rest of his life. Yeah. And some people says, Rafael, that the opposite of veganism is a carnivore diet. What do you think about the carnivore diet? Is it a diet that we can rely on, or is it just another fad? Or is it sustainable? It is possible. Is it possible to get all the nutrients from a carnivore diet?
So I used to think that we needed a certain amount of plant and especially fiber. In fact, I have Twitter messages from 7, 8 years ago where I'm discussing these things with friends saying, low carb is fine because you can still have plants and all the fiber and it's healthy. So I definitely was from the mainstream view before. Then I, read a lot, talked to people who have been using it therapeutically, started reading the research that is on it, even the historical records that date back hundreds, even thousands of years on this diet being used. And I think carnivore is the opposite of vegan in terms of like plant to animal ratio. So in the simple sense, yes, it's the opposite, but it's not equivalent, meaning that it's not the other extreme that's also bad. It's actually the other extreme that's perfectly natural and we're well adapted to it. Now, that doesn't mean it's the optimal diet. I actually don't know what the optimal diet is. I don't know if it's 100% animals, 70% animals, 80%. I don't know. It's very hard to answer and probably different answers for different people at different times. But in general, the carnivore diet is a perfectly good option for people to consider. It's very easy in terms of time. It's time saving compared to a diet where you cook a lot and the vegetables go bad and there's many simple aspects. It's also a bit more complicated socially, of course, when you can't have the pasta, the bread, the cake, all of these things. So there is good aspects to it and bad aspects to it, but I would say the bad aspects are mostly social or even cost if you can only afford if you can only have access to expensive meat. But if you plan, if you budget, normally, like, I'm going to focus on eggs, ground beef, butter. These things are not that expensive, and you can have a very high quality diet for not expensive at all. So it really depends how you approach it. And then from the health aspect, I mean, from the health aspect, it's helped so many people gain health that they could not have gained otherwise. And people with very serious mental disorders like bipolar, people with very serious autoimmune issues who have had joints replaced because of their arthritis or their asthma. So lots of different autoimmune conditions. And of course, diabetics and people who are obese. A lot of people have used these strategies. And very interestingly, anorexics. So although the carnivore is now known for weight loss, actually anorexic people who are extremely close to dying because they're so lean and low fat, they have been using it because it helps regulate appetite. It helps fight food addictions. And this is really interesting because maybe it's the low carb, but sometimes low carb is not enough for everyone. And sometimes carnivore takes them this bit further so that they can free themselves of addiction. And it's very interesting because we don't know what's going on here. It's totally new. Yeah. This is cutting edge. And I think it's really exciting time because now it's not just 10 anecdotes. It's tens of thousands of anecdotes, some observational data. We're having the first clinical trials that are already underway. We had a ketogenic diet for bipolar just come out. We have a carnivore diet study that's ongoing. So in the next few years, we're really going to be able to, I think Sean Baker has helped make that happen. I think it's ongoing. So we will have now some real evidence behind it as well. And I think it's going to be very, very interesting because it will... you will see it attacked immensely in the media. And that's a good sign that it's having an interesting impact on people.
You said one thing that's very interesting, that we don't have a specific one diet for, to paraphrase Lord of the Rings, one diet to rule them all. We don't have one diet because we have... We are the species that colonized all the planets. We have we have human beings in Arctic situations. We have human beings in tropical situations, and we can have one diet that serves for a person that is in the tropical and in the Arctic. We got, if you analyze. I know that's not the best thing to summarize a diet, but if you analyze a Hadza that lives in the equatorial in Tanzania, and we take an Inuit diet, we have it's obvious that we have to have some difference. The Inuit is not able to plant anything. He will survive in meat from seal, whale, and some ground mammals of a baby. But if we have a Hadza, we have animals that are leaner, animals that are smaller, and we have to survive a little more on tubers, maybe on honey. So our evolution and our spread through all the biomes in the earth made us omnivores because the environment was a great pressure for our. But as I study about this, Rafael, I saw that even in populations that usually eat a lot of plants, animal foods are praised.
Exactly.
And there is a population, a civilization, an ancient civilization that even saves some foods for higher level people in their tribes, like the liver. The liver is just for the elderly that have this right. So I think that we can say, beyond no doubt, that animals are important for our health.
And actually, you know, it's funny because plants are too, but personally, I think they have a more important role as medicines than as food. I mean, they also have a role as food because they're the food of our food, of the animals that are eating them. So they're important for us. And it's really, you know, the people tend to see things always as a combative, you know, or yeah. opposed. But in this sense, it's I don't think it's the right way to conceptualize it because, yes, humans are hypercarnivores for all the reasons we said, but it's beautiful and amazing and very enriching to understand that we're extremely well adapted to consuming, like you said, diets from all over the world. I mean, we're really unique, I think, in this way. There are very few animals that have as varied a diet as humans can, especially because humans can cook. So they can really yeah. make it even more varied and take things that are totally toxic and make them not bad or even good. And that's incredible, right? It's a testament that we're a very unique species and our diet is complex. So this is why this vegan versus carnivore, it's missing the point. It's yes, we're hypercarnivores, but there's incredible variety. And I think that the more sick you are, the less you're able to handle the millions of chemicals that are in plants that they use as defenses. So this is not because plants are bad. It's just because you're adapted to handle a certain amount at different phases in your life, right? It's normal. Even if you go kill an animal, the stomach contents were sometimes consumed by the people. And this had, you know, plants matter, a bit of a fecal matter. I mean, it's a mess of things. And humans can handle this to some extent. When you're sick in the modern world where people are weak and have all sorts of diseases, maybe it's not possible to enjoy as much variety as we once were able to. And that's a pity, but it's just a fact. We have to adapt to it to take care of our health. And we should not take the decision ideologically. We should be open to the type of diet that's going to really enable us to live a quality life.
Yeah, yeah. I agree with you. If you can shift gears just a little bit, and could you talk a little bit more about your PhD projects and the keto diet and the mental health? I'm asking this because I recently read the Christopher Palmer book, Brain Energy. Yes. It's a great book. And my wife is a psychiatrist. It's getting graduating in psychiatrist. And I have some patients that I'm trying to introduce in a keto diet for that matter. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So at the time when I started my PhD in 2018, I was at Universidade do Minho in Braga, in northern Portugal. And I was part of ESR, so early stage researcher. And these were projects that were sort of prepared. They already had the topic ready. So I was looking for a program and I came across this program, which was looking at the metabolic side effects of antipsychotics in a rodent model of schizophrenia. So this, in theory, had nothing to do with keto. But of course, I was hugely interested in it. So I managed to get the keto diet into some of the rats to see how they would react. So that was the goal of the study. Now, I would love to say so much more about it, but unfortunately, I never got to publish the results and some of the data I couldn't finalize. So I have I have the data on the weight. I have some of the data on the behavior. But some of the data of the blood, but it's not a complete picture. But essentially, I can talk to you about the general concepts behind yeah. ketogenic diet and schizophrenia. So schizophrenia and bipolar, they're very stable in populations, meaning they're around 1%, 1.5% in many different countries all over the world. So it's interesting because a lot of diseases like diabetes, obesity, they've gotten so common, right? They've skyrocketed. So why hasn't schizophrenia and bipolar skyrocketed? Is it because of genetic? We don't know, right? So it's an interesting question. And when you try to understand what's the difference between the brain of someone with schizophrenia or bipolar and a person who doesn't have these problems, it's hard to distinguish them. So you have some things like they have a bit of less brain matter in certain areas. You know, they may have different levels of GABA and glutamate, the excitatory and calming neurotransmitters. So we can look at these differences, but we're not exactly sure. One of the differences I found that I think explains why Christopher Palmer saw these patients of his with like 20 years of a terrible mental disorder get better very quickly on the ketogenic diet, I think it's because it changed the energy state of the brain. What is the energy state? The energy state, there's one way to think of it. It's the redox state. So reduction oxidation, it's shortened to the redox state. And this is basically like the charge of a battery. The processes in your, everywhere, not just in your brain, but everywhere in your body is oxidation, reduction, oxidation, reduction. That's how you get metabolism, energy, everything. And the redox state in the schizophrenic bipolar brain is very imbalanced. It's very high in NADH and low in NAD+. And this is a sign of an energy crisis that shouldn't be the case in the brain. And in part, they have, it's maybe not insulin resistance of the brain, like in Alzheimer's, but it's something similar, where the energy is not stable. And this means that the neurotransmitters that require a stable metabolism get produced in the wrong amounts, and the wrong signals get sent to the brain. So people can hallucinate, people can get paranoid. The brain is dysfunctional, basically. And when the energy source is not stable, then dysfunction happens. So I think this is the very basic, simplified theory behind Christopher Palmer's book, Brain Energy Metabolism. And actually, he was very kind. He advised me in 2018, 2019 on the PhD, how I should, you know, consider to conduct the experiment. So he was very helpful to me personally. And his anecdotes were so intriguing that I had to, you know, have a keto arm in the experiment to try and see what happened. So I don't know for sure if the ketogenic diet helped those rats, you know, because I didn't get to finish the full analysis. But it was curious that a lot of the benefits that people are getting by fasting or doing ketogenic diet when they're schizophrenic, you know, also fixes a lot of other things. You know, it fixes addiction issues. It fixes their metabolism, which is the opposite of a lot of the antipsychotics. The antipsychotics, it's debatable if they work. It's really, really debatable. It's not clear. Some patients seem to have improvement. Others really no improvement. But what they all have is side effects. And it's hard to think that they're very useful if the side effects they are doing are going to cause dysfunction in the brain because of unstable energy.
Yeah.
So I think it's much more promising to look at ketone supplements, fasting, ketogenic diets, and other medications or interventions. Even sleep-related interventions can stabilize brain energy levels, or stress reduction interventions. Anything that's going to help brain metabolism is very strongly likely going to help these patients, and also depressed patients, anxious patients, but even the very serious schizophrenics and bipolar disorders.
That's very interesting. Very interesting indeed. Rafael, I don't want to be disrespectful with your time, but there are two questions that I always ask my guests here. One is, what are your health and longevity strategies do you use in your daily life? I know you are a CrossFitter. And what more? How is your sleep, your diet? Tell a little bit about this.
Yeah. So my diet is largely a result of a condition that I developed when I was around 25 years old. I developed ulcerative colitis. So for people who don't know, it's when your colon is inflamed. So you don't really digest fiber very well. You have digestive problems, you know, you're sort of limited in what you can eat without having symptoms. So the way I found to manage this, I don't take medication, but I eat a mostly carnivore diet. So I would say 95% carnivore on the average day. So mostly meat, fish, cheese, cream, eggs, some liver sometimes, you know, some things like that. And you know, rarely I'll have, well, actually not rarely, but I'll have some honey, Sometimes I have some sugar, but small amounts. So I'm mostly carnivore. Like you said, I CrossFit a lot. I do trail running. I love being outside, do some swimming. I do ice baths. So I love cold exposure. It's really a favorite thing of mine. I think just for the mental health benefits, I would, you know, always keep doing that. That's very powerful. I do also a breath work, Wim Hof breath work, which is called hypocapnic hyperventilation. And this, you know, allows you to take control of your autonomous nervous system. So you can start getting warm. You have basically released a lot of adrenaline. So it's very anti-inflammatory. You know, it's very energizing. And this is also a good de-stressing technique for breathing. Then sleep, I'm very particular about my sleep. You know, bedtime for me is 10, 11, really at the latest. Usually I get up, you know, around 6 a.m. So I'm very consistent. I'm a good sleeper. And yeah, that's pretty much it. I spend as much time I can outside and connect a lot with friends, family, and acquaintances where we share common interests. And this makes it very, very fulfilling, very fun for me.
Great, great. And the other question is, I always ask for a book recommendation, one that impacted your life, regardless of the subject. It could be on any subject. Do you have any jewel for us?
Yeah, actually, I have two authors. So one impacted me very directly. That's Gary Taubes. He's a science journalist, very famous now in the low-carb keto world. So Good Calories, Bad Calories, but he also wrote Why We Get Fat, The Case Against Sugar, The Case for Keto, and the latest book, Rethinking Diabetes, that I still have to read, actually. I haven't read that one. So any of his books by Gary Taubes is great. And then there's also Nick Lane. He's basically he's the guy who studies the origins of life. So from a chemistry, biochemistry perspective, so you know him. And he's great. He wrote a book on oxygen, on mitochondria, on evolution, on the question, you know, what is life, and the chemistry of life and death. So all of his books, especially the mitochondria one, I think is for
Power, Sex, and Suicide.
Yeah, exactly.
I have this one. It's an absolutely great book.
Oh, nice. Fantastic. Yeah, so any of the books from these two authors, Gary Taubes and Nick Lane, they're fantastic.
Great. And when is it that is your book coming out? Are you writing some?
I haven't thought of a book, but maybe one day. Maybe one day. You put the idea in my head and it will grow.
Okay. My friend, thank you very much for accepting the invitation. Thank you very much for being here. It was a great talk. And I hope we meet in the future in person. Who knows? And in a convention or when I go in France, I really, really loved our conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Enrique. It was a pleasure. It was very, very cool for me to talk to you. And congratulations on everything you're doing and all the good advice you're putting out there. So please do it. I work with a Brazilian girl who would be very happy that you're helping Brazil get out of the junk food problem like so many other countries have. So anything I can do to help, but please just ask. And yeah, I hope we meet at a conference soon.
Thank you.
That'd be great.
That'll be great. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.